Hello, Internet. This is David Rovix, hosting another episode of Fifth Estate Live, which comes to you under the auspices of Fifth Estate Magazine, produced by one of the long-standing members of the editorial collective of Fifth Estate Magazine, Peter Werby. Comes to you every Tuesday at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. in Belfast, 7 p.m. in Berlin. On the Facebook pages of Popular Resistance and KABU Community Radio and various other platforms. And it all goes up later on a playlist on fifthestate.org. And you can also find it if you look for This Week with David Rovix, wherever you get your podcasts. It goes up in podcast form as well as on YouTube and Twitter, Facebook, and various other places. And today we have the great honor of spending the hour with longtime organizer, author of many books, both fiction and nonfiction, for quite a long, decades long career as a professor at Wayne State University, Fran Shore. Fran, it's great to have you.
Hi, thank you, David. Thanks to the FE also for being able to run this and, Thank you for the music too.
Oh heck yeah, yeah! And there are people watching the broadcast who are enjoying it on a regular basis out there.
Good.
It's always hard to know who they are exactly, but they're out there. And and there's the new. Oh, I should mention also the new issue of Fifth Estate Magazine, which is a primarily print magazine. It's a quarterly print magazine, and the new issue, number 407, which features a brilliant cover by Seth Tabachman, also features a sort of a very timely review of The Plague by you, which
right.
an article as well by me and many other folks. But can we start there? It was also very interesting. I was just reading your review, which highlighted some points about Camus that I didn't know about. This is probably the most discussion that the book The Plague has gotten since possibly since it was published. I don't know, but it's certainly, I've never heard so much. I hear about The Plague every day and I still haven't read it, but can you talk about the relevance of The Plague at the moment?
Yeah. I mean, you know, part of it is of course that Camus was involved in the resistance during World War II. He had started out in the 30s with the Communist Party, but began to make a move towards anarchism, which was very interesting. And in fact, Camus' philosophy, his political philosophy, is something that I've been wrestling with since my time as a graduate student and I became a draft resister. Camus was actually the rebel, was the Bible that I used to try to define what my politics were. And I still think one of the insights that Camus had about what he calls altruistic individualism is a really wonderful way of describing a form of anarchism, I think, which informed a lot of those of us who became radicals in the 1960s. Camus' relevance in post-World War Europe in particular was because, as a member of the resistance, to some extent, the plague was a metaphor for fascism. And although it shouldn't really be reduced to that, political formation, it has a larger meaning. And it's taken on that larger meaning with the coronavirus and the worldwide pandemic of coronavirus. So what I was interested in particular, was how Camus discusses, in a period when people are fearful, paranoid, how we create solidarity. And Camus, again, helps us navigate how we think about, in the context of a awful biological infection, how we think about we're going to connect with each other, even though contact may lead to sickness and death. So he talks a lot about an ultimate form of solidarity called social solidarity. There's different forms that he discusses of civic solidarity and social solidarity. And social solidarity is, I think, what we've seen practiced in the post-George Floyd assassination demonstrations, that people are prepared in the name of humanity, in the name of Black Lives Matter, which is the signal flag now for humanity redeemed. I think that that issue of creating social solidarity also informs how people can go into the streets masked, trying to keep a certain level of social distance, not always achieving that, but saying that this issue of racial justice, this issue of being treated as a human being, this issue of how our humanity literally trumps, and I want to underscore that word, literally trumps the viciousness, the xenophobia, the racism, the misogyny, the ableism of this power structure, that doing that is a way of manifesting one's humanity. And I think that's what connects the work of Camus in The Plague to his other writings, to the novel that I just finished, Passages of Rebellion, and to the collection of essay on weaponized whiteness, in particular on the issue of how people contest white supremacy and white identity politics.
I wonder if when one of the aspects of the plague also this was exploring the social isolation of having this kind of, which of course there's so many parallels with fascism and the social isolation of everybody mistrusting everybody else because right. They're afraid they're going to go to the camps if somebody calls the police, but I wonder how well was the, like, if you using the plague as a metaphor, how well does it actually hold up when you're talking about an actual plague?
Well, surprisingly well, which is why it has become such a bestseller now. I think people have gone back to it to look at the issue of how you contend with a time. And of course, this was limited to the city in Algeria. So it wasn't as if this was a worldwide phenomenon, which in fact coronavirus is, but it did strike a resonant note when you consider the issue, as you raised, David, of fear of social isolation in particular. And it tends to, and Camus talks about this, it tends to reinforce the sense that I'm only out for myself. I've got to look after number one. I can't really think about anybody else because if I'm going to survive, I have to keep my own survival at the foremost. And that's where you see Camus trying to parse out what it means for people to transcend that narrow, isolated sensibility. And so I think it obviously has applicability. He's talking about the bubonic plague, in effect, right? Mm. I mean, which goes back to the Middle Ages, at least. It has a longer trajectory than that. But in terms of how devastating it was, the Middle Ages was clearly that period of when millions were just wiped out. The reappearance of these biological global infections is another lesson, I think, that we need to be reminded of, because we haven't really addressed the deep-rooted problem, which is not just let's get a vaccine, right? The deep-rooted problem is we're destroying the habitat of animals. We're chaining them and putting them in factory farms where these kinds of infections can spread. And we've got these global chains that operate as capitalist links in the new chain of production and consumption that also lead to the worldwide spread of these kinds of infections. So again, I think even though Camus was writing in the midst of World War II looking at a narrow sense of what kind of infection can wreak havoc, I think it has really major applicability.
Yeah, I'd say so. And there's when you mentioned the what was the word that you used, that Black Lives Matter is like the sort of signal flag of humanity, of being truly human, and in the present age, you said it even more succinctly than that. It was very good. But the fact that the coronavirus is so especially devastating to Black people in this society because of socioeconomics just adds so much more fuel to the fire, and also underscores, I think, so many of the basic premises in your book about weaponized whiteness. And I wonder if, I mean, there's just so many, in the particular historical juncture we're in, there is just any number of different threads to explore when it comes to this theme. But when I'm talking with people in Europe, and I used to spend half of my time in Europe and touring in Europe for a long time now, for largely economic reasons, but also, you know, there are societies there that need people playing music in them as well. But the sort of intersection of class and race in the United States, it's not like unique to the United States, right. but in many ways it is so much more the case here than it is in so many societies. And I don't know if that's a starting point, but let's get into this the book that you published only just last year, which also seems very prescient that it was. And of course, Black Lives Matter became a phrase in 2014 and became a movement, and the movement really, of course, predates the phrase. At this particular juncture, it's quite a time to come out with a book called Weaponized Whiteness.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's obviously is a time when better known authors like Ibram Kendi on his book on anti-racism, those have certainly become really important in trying to understand how we develop anti-racist politics. And so my book is basically pulling together a number of essays, some that had previously been published that I updated, and some that had not yet been published. So there are actually two different sections of it. One which tries to do a historical overview of the emergence of white supremacy as a racial formation in the 16th and 17th century in the United States, and taking a look in particular then at what I consider to be institutionalized white supremacist terror. And I think we often overlook that. Here I am in Michigan, the home of the Wolverine Watchmen.
Yeah, it's like, case in point.
I mean, these crazed domestic terrorists, have been around for a long time, but we...
In case anybody watching is unfamiliar with, has missed the recent news, we're talking about far right white supremacists in Michigan who just were involved with a plot to kidnap the governor. And then Trump's response to this
all over a mask
finding about this was to about wearing masks.
All over wearing masks.
And then Trump's response was to criticize the governor some more.
Yeah, and that's how the misconstrual of liberty, which is often trumped freedom, the idea of freedom in this culture, like you're not going to impose upon my freedom to be able to wear a mask. Well, to go back again to Camus, you know, he doesn't want to separate the fact that altruism has to be seen as part and parcel of any kind of individualism. In other words, you have to take responsibility, in particular this environment, for being aware of what cause of suffering may occur because of your irresponsibility or because you're blind. And historically, the white blind spot has been the place that whites in particular, operating out of an archive of white supremacy, have not been able to really understand and appreciate and develop the kind of empathy that's absolutely essential to be able to create a just society. So part of it is historical, and what I try to do is look at the way that warfare, going back to the early settler colonialist, as a settler, white settler colonialist experience, how exterminating native peoples was part and parcel of the creation of the nation. And it still continues in the way in which the pipeline in North Dakota, I mean, if you read the work of people like Nick Estes or Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz about the history of what's gone on with indigenous people and the oppressive culture that has expropriated not just land, but expropriated culture and led often to extermination. I mean, that's what I try to deal with this discussion I have of what's called savage war. You know, it was used, and you have a great song, David, the Resistance song, right? Mm-hmm. That use these tropes of manifest destiny, of savages at our border, that in fact, you don't look at the practice, then excuses the practice of promulgating savage war, exterminationist war against those who you impute certain motives to.
I thought in Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz's book, The People's History of an Indigenous People's History of the United States. I mean, there's so much great stuff in that book, but one of the parts that really especially struck me was just how much a part of the colonial economy scalps were.
Yes. Yeah. Not only, you know, I have a section of my book where I talk specifically about in California, if I can just.
Please.
So in 1834, California Native Americans numbered around 150,000. By the end of the 19th century, that number would be less than 20,000. Seeking the land occupied by those indigenous inhabitants, Leland Stanford is a name we need to cancel because I don't call it cancel culture. It's restorative justice.
Yeah. Right?
So Leland Stanford and other wealthy white transplants financially underwrote what were euphemistically called Indian hunting expeditions. Just stop for a moment. Yeah. Indian hunting expeditions, which actually were murderous assaults on California Native Americans. When Stanford became governor of California in 1861, he expropriated state finances to expedite further extermination, all in the name, of course, of white civilization and progress. And that trope of white civilization and progress can be seen not just throughout the 19th century in internal colonialism, but then as the imperialist empire begins to move outward, it's so immediately relevant to all the way from the war in the Philippines, which the officer class talked about as exterminating Indians. They had just come from the plains and from places where they had already done that. And even all the way through Vietnam, right? Where we talk about the war in Vietnam, where they talk about going into Indian country.
Mm-hmm.
And through even the war in Iraq, where they talk about savages. If you've seen this execrable film on the, about the sniper, Kyle,
What's this, American Sniper?
Yeah, the American Sniper. I mean, his autobiography is filled with discussion of, I want to exterminate all these savages. It's the same over and over again, these same tropes, because it is fundamentally a racial formation that's become part and parcel of the imperial project. And to the degree that we don't understand how deeply rooted that is, we miss out on the need to really rid our culture of empire as it's practiced and as it continues to be practiced. So the other long formation then that I talk about is policing.
Mm-hmm.
It's as an institutionalized white supremacist terror, that it goes back to the slave patrols, that it continues through the 19th and 20th century, when white terror states in the South operated like Mississippi did, as essentially practicing constant white supremacist terror. Once the sheets were put away, the white sheets were put away, the blue uniforms could come on, and the same sort of abysmal treatment of people of color could persist until and unless, and this has happened periodically and now in, I think, a really heroic way, Black Lives Matter and resistance occurs in the streets, in the courts, and wherever it can be done to staunch this terror.
Mm-hmm. And the history of the police, the armies of police in suppressing the labor movement as well, which also goes hand in hand with the suppressing the slave uprisings.
Yes, absolutely. I don't talk about that as much. But certainly there are wonderful histories that do describe in detail the way in which urban police forces were brought into effect because they couldn't rely on some of the militias to put down these labor insurgencies since, like in 1877 in Pittsburgh in particular, they tried to bring out the local militia and it was their cousins and brothers out on line, so they put their arms down, turned their arms around, you know, and said, "Oh my God, Frick and Carnegie had to rely then on private repressive instruments, and then eventually, looked to the cities and governments to establish police forces."
To socialize their expenses, to make taxpayers pay for them to suppress, to have police to suppress us. Yeah.
And of course, as we learned from Ferguson, it's not always, although what we see and what is most reprehensible is, a cop like Darren Wilson murdering a young man like Michael Brown in the streets and essentially getting away with murder, right? But what even the Justice Department was able to look into was how much people of color, black residents of St. Louis and Ferguson were constantly being harassed by the legal system. You have a light out in the back of your car, your back light is out. You get a ticket, they slap you with a ticket. You can't make the payment, you get another fine, you get into jail. I mean, the way in which all of this would just start an avalanche of repression and exploitation was evident in all of the data that was collected by the DOJ about what went on in Ferguson. And it wasn't just isolated to Ferguson.
It's all over the country, and it's one of the when I was hearing a lot about all that in Ferguson in 2014, it was becoming a sort of national talking point kind of news story about what it's like to just drive while black in a place like Ferguson. It was, I mean, for me, it was very interesting because from just an autobiographical perspective, because as a teenager and in my early 20s, I had long hair and I dressed in freakish clothing and I drove old cars with lots of bumper stickers on them. So I was, you know, profiled constantly. I was constantly pulled over for that. Just and I, you know, and I'm a white guy, you know, but and if that's happening to me, you know, you can imagine. Of course, for me, all the treatment changed radically as soon as I was driving a slightly newer car and cut my hair, you know, so it's very easy to exit that profiling category.
The invisibility of whiteness. And that's what I try to do then in the second part of the book is, and I use a little bit of the my own experiences in the 1960s becoming active with Friends of SNCC and with establishing a freedom school in Pittsburgh when I was an undergraduate at the University of Pittsburgh. And I think what went on was not only the modern civil rights movement with incredible black leadership become a beacon to us young whites who wanted to become not just allies, but wanted to act in strict and strong social solidarity. It was a matter of also a different form of double consciousness. Du Bois talks about double consciousness for African Americans in the souls of black folk. But for whites, we had to also understand that our whiteness hid us from the advantages that we had because of the nature of white supremacy. And then once recognizing that, you had to, in fact, figure out how you become something other than, you know, an instrument of white solidarity and white supremacy. So I talk a lot about unveiling whiteness, what that means, how Black Lives Matter in particular, in one of the chapters, Black Lives Matter really put the country on notice again. And it wasn't, again, you know, all these incidents came together. Trayvon Martin, the murder of Trayvon Martin, the murder of Oscar Grant out in, for those who don't remember it, I mean, Oscar Grant, if you can see the Fruitvale Station, which is a brilliant film.
Wonderful film.
That recreates that. I mean, you know, just murdered by a BART transit cop whose defense was, oh, I was reaching for my taser. I didn't know.
Pulled out the wrong gun. Didn't notice.
And he shoots him in the back.
While handcuffed on the platform.
Yeah. So, you know, and these go on and on and on. And I think what Black Lives Matter was able to do, and the reason that I use it almost as a concluding chapter, is that it challenges weaponized whiteness, not only in its lethal form with police violence, but also in its legal form, in its underground form, as elements of the way that there is constant disparity between those who inhabit a privileged world and those who are people of color, you know, in a much more difficult environment. And again, COVID, as you point out really early on, COVID's a wonderful or actually tragic a representation of those inequities, the lack of decent healthcare that still persists in this country, the lack of access to really decent food also, you know, the level of the stress levels that operate just in, you know, being a person of color. I mean, all of those sort of come together to make people much more vulnerable.
Overcrowded housing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The housing is really something else, seeing around, looking around at any city in this country, especially around here in Portland, and just from block to block, you can see it if you know what to look for, that like people are living two or three families in a two bedroom apartment, and then the next two bedroom apartment has one person in it, you know, and it'll just be on one block, the kind of disparities that exist. Just
saying, that kind of spatial racialized ecology is very evident in Detroit too. For those who've been to Detroit, you can drive down one of the spokes. Detroit is like, you know, is on the river. It has a main spoke that comes out called Woodward Avenue. It has one that goes west and one that goes east. Jefferson is the spoke that goes east, and it runs right through the east side of Detroit and then into Grosse Pointe. And it is like literally night and day, because you have these sheltered suburbs. And Grosse Pointe used to actually have a point system right through the 1950s, where they would eliminate people of color and Jews and Italians from moving in. So this practice that Richard Rothstein calls the color of law, how it was deeply rooted and embedded in housing practices, in the way that those were upheld in legal opinions. I mean, all of that, I think, you know, it takes a required observation of how we arrived at that point and the way in which we need to deconstruct it. So, again, that's what weaponized whiteness tries to do.
What about one of the things that I found so interesting in a history book, and I can't remember offhand the name of the author, but the book was titled White Trash. And the book was, I thought, a really fascinating exploration of class and race in the United States. And one of the points the author was making, I mean, implicitly, basically, was that although clearly racism and white supremacy have benefited. What is going on? My phone's ringing through the computer. I don't know if anybody else is hearing that.
I'm not hearing it, David.
Oh, good. Okay. the phenomenon of although obviously with in so many ways many white people have benefited so much materially and in so many other ways from white supremacy in the United States. At the same time, it's this same phenomenon of white supremacy is used and as a tool to get a lot of cheap labor out of a whole lot of people, including a lot of poor white people.
Exactly. Right?
So can you talk about that phenomenon?
Yeah, I mean, in my epilogue, what I tried to do is, you know, throughout these essays is on the issue of racial capitalism. And the way in which, you know, capital establishes a system of domination and control, and in inequalities, trying in effect to use race as a way to, and those racial formations, to create white solidarity, when in fact these, you know, people are getting the poorer whites are getting screwed, and as Bobby Dylan so eloquently sang, only a pawn in their game.
Oh, nice, Dylan. Yeah, very good. And that's
part of that is also about, you know, the murder assassination of Medgar Evers, which I discuss in this chapter on restorative justice and the way in which we deal with the ghosts of the past, including monuments and memorials, which we can talk a little bit more about. But the epilogue deals with this incredible play that came out a couple of years ago by Lynn Nottage called Sweat. And she went in to look at Allentown, at whites in Allentown.
In Pennsylvania.
You know, been devastated by deindustrialization.
Mm-hmm.
And she wondered, you know, what's going on here? The people feel abandoned. They felt in some ways that they no longer amounted to anything. In some ways, the Trumpism is actually a compensatory for some of those white working class and poor whites who feel like they've been so humiliated by the system, they want somebody else to humiliate, to be their humiliator in chief, who can take on people of color in particular.
And that goes way back, that whole phenomenon. Huh?
And the book, I think, that's really a great read, and one that I recommend to everybody, is this book by Jonathan Metzl called Dying of Whiteness. What he does that's so brilliant is he goes into these states like, for example, Kansas, and he looks at the healthcare system in a place like Kansas, and then looks in another state that has a more decent healthcare system where they have Medicare for all, or Medicaid at least has been expanded, not Medicare for all, if we only had that. And you know, he takes a look at suicide rates among whites. I mean, two thirds of the gun violence in the United States, the 40,000 deaths per year of gun violence, are by suicide, and the majority of that are among whites.
Yeah.
Despondent, despairing, having these lethal weapons around in their homes.
And they're told they're supposed to be amounting to something. And then when they don't, they blame themselves.
Exactly. Exactly. That's what long ago, in another really excellent book by Richard Sennett called The Hidden Injuries of Class. So what I do is I look at that recent play by this brilliant African-American playwright, Lynn Nottage. And I talk about it through the lens of the hidden injuries of class, the way in which these white workers in particular, feel that they've been ostracized and they need to look around if they can't find a hook for the solidarity, they look for a hook for stereotyping and scapegoating.
And what about the role of the Democratic Party in this process? I mean, historically, people are, may or may not be aware that the Democratic Party was the party of the white man, and that's how they advertised themselves a century ago. But in the modern Democratic Party, in the course of the Clinton and Obama administrations, people overall, the working class suffered in this country while the economy, while the business press was crowing on about how the economy was booming, by which they meant the stock market.
Right.
The average people were suffering increasingly more and more, including the average white working class, as well as everybody else in the working class. And then it just seems like there's so many, history doesn't repeat, but there's so many parallels in terms of the rise of Trump and the rise of fascism in both Italy and Germany.
And I think it is. It's the when I talk about Trumpism, I try to situate it in a longer arc and bring into the conversation neoliberalism that Clinton and Obama were representatives of, and it's that neoliberalism that helped to deindustrialize, impoverish a whole class of people, and I think that what is important to understand is that when push came to shove, Obama could have and should have dealt with the crisis, the housing crisis, because it particularly impacted people of color, blacks in particular, whose only measure of wealth was their house.
Once they lost their houses
by predatory lenders, they had nothing. There could have been a moratorium. There should have been a moratorium, right? But that would have been taking on the banking class, taking on Goldman Sachs and others, the people who populated Clinton and
his cabinet. Both of their cabinets.
And which
how
is why they're
Goldman
saying,
Sachs
and now they're saying,
former executives, it's amazing.
And now they're saying about Joe Biden, he'll be great.
Oh, yeah. He'll be full of
Goldman Sachs.
White male Goldman Sachs former executives. And why that bank? I mean, there's so many other major banks. Why? But that one is incredibly influential in American politics.
Yeah. Well, more so with the Democrats, although not exclusively.
Yeah.
I want to read a passage, if I may. I think the person who really nailed this best is Cornel West. Mm-hmm. And I quote West in this discussion of white identity politics and the terrors of Trumpism. I say, he says, while Trump is a sign of our spiritual bankruptcy, all spectacle and no substance, all narcissism and no empathy, all appetite and greed and no wisdom and maturity, his triumph flows from the implosion of a Republican Party establishment beholden to big money, big military, and big scapegoating of vulnerable peoples of color, LGBTQ peoples, immigrants, Muslims, and women. It also flows from a Democratic Party establishment beholden to big money, big military, and the clever deployment of peoples of color, LGBTQ peoples, immigrants, Muslims, and women, to hide and conceal the lies and crimes of neoliberal policies here and abroad, and from a corporate media establishment that aided and abetted Trump, owing to high profits and revenues.
Yeah, I mean, he so often says it best, huh?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I can't put it any better and more concisely than West.
But that yeah, that's
Let me, if I may, David, also, there was just a new manifesto that came out that was put out by, I don't know if you saw this, by Mumia Abu-Jamal and Alice Walker, among the various people who signed this. And it's called A Manifesto for Our Times, The Challenge to Abolish Systemic Racism. And I'd highly recommend that. I found it on Counterpunch the other day. So you might be able to see it, but I think they do a really good job of very concise discussion of systemic racism that I try to do in much more, you know, academic style sometimes.
Yeah.
And they also suggest certain things that need to be changed.
The insidiousness of using people from marginalized groups as your sort of cause when you're like for the Democratic Party, to use them, different marginalized groups as sort of your sort of picture people and your image of this is the intersectional group of people from society that you represent without really representing their fundamental interests as overwhelmingly members of the working class, among whatever other interest, but it's overwhelmingly we're talking about the people who, yeah, as you say, if they own anything, they own one house and they've just lost it under a Democratic administration. And it's just the insidiousness is, it's hard to overstate how much of a role the Democratic Party plays in building support for Trump.
That being said, I would be remiss if I didn't say, and here's my little plug on my little grandstand, this is a referendum on Trumpism.
This election.
It's a referendum on Trumpism. And although I think we're seeing a slow-moving coup, I think people need to be advised. That's all. You make the choice, but know that it is a referendum on Trumpism. I'm not touting any particular candidate. Anyhow, is it possible to move on to?
Yes, let's talk. Can we talk about this wonderful novel that you've just published?
Yes.
Because it's a semi-autobiographical novel written just prior to the outbreak of COVID and the uprisings, which is quite a time to write a novel.
Well, it was actually written while
during the pandemic.
Oh, right. Yeah, I mean, I had to find some way, hunkering down, that I could relieve my creative juices, and this is, you know, writing is often the way that I do it. So I just decided, you know, I want to try to see if I can manage a foray into fiction.
It was your first novel?
Yes.
Yeah. And did your work as writing nonfiction help with the process, or more was it a hindrance, or did you have to relearn?
I think it was both a help and a hindrance. It's a help in the sense that I knew I needed and I wanted to ground this novel which takes place mostly in 1967 to 1970 in Minneapolis, when I was a grad student, an anti-war activist, and a draft resister, actually the first person to publicly refuse induction in Minneapolis. I wanted it to be informed by what was going on with the war and how vicious that was and how it was so much a part of my consciousness at the time and our consciousness as we were building this this movement against the war. And
the knowledge of what the war really meant for the people in Vietnam.
Right.
About millions of people being killed from the air, skin being burned off by
chemical weapons. Right. So, you know, I start a passage, for example, when he comes onto campus. I think it was, there's also, there's also an updated version of what's going on. It doesn't just stick in the 60s. There's a connection to the women's movement, to something else happening. And I wanted to just see if I can, read these two passages.
Oh, yeah, please.
This is the start of classes at the University of Minnesota in mid-September 1967 marked the transition from hot, humid summer days to the increasingly crisp ones in the fall. As Frank, and this is the protagonist and sort of semi-autobiographical character, Franklin Roosevelt Goodman, as Frank stepped onto the bucolic campus with its walkways bordered by deciduous trees whose leaves were beginning to turn to orange autumnal colors, there was a slight chill in the air. Apparently, for the vast majority of students who were part of the crush on the first day of the fall quarter, the air temperature was no deterrence to the wearing of lightweight clothes. For native-born Minnesotans grown used to the viciously frigid winter season, a 55-degree day was still rather balmy. In the jungles of South Vietnam, the 19-year-old draftees, out on search and destroy missions, sweated under the oppressive heat and humidity, not fully comprehending that they were being used as bait to lure out into the open the stealthy Viet Cong. Meanwhile, flying high above in the cool innards of US B-52 bombers, cocky Air Force crews dropped tons of heavy ordnance onto South and North Vietnamese villages. Those not obliterated by these tremendous explosions soon became the targets of US jets dropping containers of newly improved napalm, whose adhesive properties stuck to their burning flesh. A second strafing by other planes on villagers in the North and the South, rushing into the open from obliterated schools and hospitals, would often consist of anti-personnel cluster bombs that would release hundreds of bomblets designed to maim whoever survived the previous gruesome onslaught from above. The sky above in Minneapolis was a clear blue.
Yeah. Yeah. Brilliant.
So yeah. There's these intrusions that are historically grounded into the fictionalized story that what I bring as a historian into work of fiction.
Yeah. And that period that you're writing about, I think in terms of what people, what is all over the media for the past few months and also social media and just on the minds of a lot of people is the comparisons between the current uprising and past social movements. And I wonder I never get tired of asking people who have actually lived through the 60s of making any comparisons that they might have, because I mean it's so hard to get a real picture of what's happening, because it's easy to be if you got a camera and you're working for some media outlet, it's easy to go into any demonstration and make it seem very large or make it seem very small.
Yeah.
You know, if you're talking about hundreds or thousands, if it's bigger than thousands, it's hard to make it seem small, but
yes.
I mean, maybe you got to get in the helicopter then, but I mean, I wonder what thoughts you have on these two movements.
Part of it is, if I can parse that into two separate,
oh, please.
I want to talk about the civil rights movement the Black freedom struggle of the 1960s and 50s, which was very evident in the mind of Black Lives Matter folks. They understood that this was a part and parcel of a long trajectory, of a long journey of a Black freedom struggle. And I think even the kids who, the Parkland kids, who I talk about in this
in Florida chapter,
Weaponized whiteness, just if I could read this one paragraph. This was when they're developing the March for Our Lives in March 2018. And I try to make a comparison then between what happened in 1963 in Birmingham with the young students and what happens now, what happened with the March for Our Lives in just recently, 2018. Prior to this march, students around the country had organized walkouts to highlight the issue of gun violence. And, you know, we were part of them here. I'm sure you had them, you know, in Portland. Not unlike the younger students who walked out in 1963 from their high schools, middle schools, and even elementary schools in Birmingham, Alabama, and Jackson, Mississippi. The difference, of course, was that whereas over 2,000 students were arrested in Birmingham, 2,000 students arrested for that walkout, there were hardly any arrests at either the walkouts or the demonstrations on March 24th. The estimates in the main event in Washington, D.C. range from 200,000 to 800,000. Truly, truly astounding. Parkland students like Cameron Caskey, David Hogg, and the amazing Emma Gonzalez spoke movingly, and there were young students of color, including this wonderful young kid, Naomi Wadler, right? So you had, and these kids were so much more, I think, aware than we were in the 60s of how everything has to be measured in this multicultural, multi-issue solidarity network. And they did an astounding job of reaching out, of making sure that was evident. There were so many times when that would prove so difficult in the 60s.
Yeah.
You know, so there's certainly, you know, there's certainly that. There's also the sense that there was a point when in the 1960s, particularly in the anti-war movement, when it was so clear that the whole idea of what the U.S. military was an instrument of imperial wars, more than willing to use young men who came from poorer backgrounds, because rich people like Donald Trump and George Walker Bush and these people could get out, go into the National Guard, right? Mm-hmm. The poverty draft, in a way, continues, even though we were able to end the draft because of how it became impossible to get people to finally agree to go in the military. And once they were there, by the late 60s and early 70s, there were incredible numbers of mutinies by the draftees.
And a lot of that had to do not just with the conditions of the war, but with the kind of organizing that folks like you are doing. Yeah, I mean, I think about this, one statistic that comes to mind to try to describe the scale of the movement at the time, which I believe is an accurate statistic, is that outside of every military base in the United States, there was at least one anti-war, physical anti-war coffee house run by the anti-war movement, which is just such an achievement as far as organizing goes.
And I think, I think what occurred then, one of the tactics, in a way, of a recuperative ruling class was to try to insist that the anti-war movement was at the time also opposed to the grunts who had to fight this war. In fact, as you pointed out with that statistic, David, we were reaching out all the time. We wanted solidarity. We wanted this kind of solidarity. And in fact, you know, by the late 60s, early 70s, these mutinies, there were whole naval vessels where the crew had actually almost taken over the ship because they were anti-war. So I think it's been a long effort to recuperate the idea that the military is just really representing you and me, as opposed to the fucking, excuse the expression, ruling class that uses them as cannon fodder to try to keep the empire, a dying one at that, the title of one of my other books, from actually collapsing.
And there was the real possibility. I mean, you had mutinies going on. You had so many military bases in Vietnam where people were much more going on search and avoid missions than search and destroy. Yes, right. And,
right. Right. So you need you need an updating of the St. Patrick's Rebellion, the St. Patrick's Brigade, for the Vietnam time.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I've also written songs about Vietnam as well.
Well, I know you have. I don't know. I know the St. Patrick's. That's such a great song. I know that.
But it's very much a theme in Vietnam. I mean, so much dissension among the ranks that the authorities were openly talking about how they, if they tried to draft more soldiers, that they would not be able to guarantee domestic tranquility. And right. I think of that phrase that one of Nixon's advisors gave him about how, no, we can't do this because we won't be able to maintain domestic tranquility. And
exactly.
Now, in the current moment, one of the many sort of things that reminds me of that is currently, according to the business press, the United States is $21 billion in debt to their landlords. Renters are $21 billion in debt. And if they were to allow the evictions to go ahead, that we'd be looking at a potential 40 million evictions all happening at the same time.
Yeah.
And, and then of course, everybody with half a brain cell can tell, like, you have an eviction moratorium, not necessarily because you're concerned about the public welfare or you're concerned about the virus spreading, but because you're concerned about not having rioting mobs of tens of millions of evicted tenants overthrowing the state.
The creation, with some notable exceptions in the 1930s, of the social safety net was precisely that point of that kind of New Deal, new liberalism that wanted to make sure people had money to spend to keep the system going. And at the same time that you could have things like unemployment insurance and, if people went out and were unemployed for long periods of time. And the fact that the Republican Party can't, that they push ahead with this handmade tale of a Supreme Court nominee while they refuse, this is the Senate, while they refuse to give more relief to people suffering from unemployment and COVID, is just morally reprehensible. I mean, I can't think of
It's morally reprehensible, and it's also like, what are they trying to do here? I mean, what is the end game? Is there an end game?
The end game, I think, is they believe somehow that most people, this is probably Trump's to his racism, the poor people should die off.
And how's that going to go? Is that going to work? Are they going to die off or rebel or both?
Well, we got robots now.
Yeah, right. But there. So, any in closing, first of all, Sven, what was the name of your novel again?
It's called, I will hold it up again for Show and Tell.
Yeah,
it is Passages of Rebellion.
Great.
And it's on Outskirts Press, so that if you go to the Outskirts Press book site website, you can get a little bit less. It's not as expensive. You can actually get a cheaper version of a PDF if you wish. You don't have to give another single nickel to Jeff Bezos.
Excellent. And in closing, Fran, do you have any particular predictions for the next few weeks in the United States?
I just think, we need to be aware, as any number of people have been saying, Noam Chomsky among others, we need to be aware that this guy is prepared to violate every single political moral norm. It's not just enough to vote in the referendum against Trumpism. You have to be mobilized to prevent a coup and to prevent the ultimate destruction of what remnants of democracy we have. And you guys in Portland have been doing a good job.
Yeah,
got to say.
And the there's a group of people. I'm not sure who they are, but it looks very good. It looks like George Lakey might be involved, but it's a 10-point plan for how to try to prevent a coup. I read this, and it was very good, and it's on the web. And I tried to share it on Twitter, and Twitter told me I could not share it because it was suspicious.
Oh my goodness!
Presumably because it uses the term coup. And it's but it's not promoting coups. It's trying to, you know, that's just whoa.
Right. Typical. Well, that's why we try to make our own.
Yeah.
Media.
Yeah. Fran, thank you so much.
Thanks, Jeffy. Oh,
pleasure.
This has been wonderful. Wish us all well, good health, and the struggle continues.
Absolutely. Yeah, we'll talk to you after the election.
Okay, take care.
Take care, friend. And thanks, everybody, for tuning in to another episode of Fifth Estate Live, which comes to you right here on this platform, whichever one you're watching on the Facebook pages of Popular Resistance, KBOO Community Radio, and on Twitter, YouTube, VK, LinkedIn, and Twitch, every Tuesday at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. in London, 7 p.m. in Copenhagen. And I'll be back next Tuesday to host another episode of Fifth Estate Live. And I believe I'll also be hosting an episode of Discussions with David tomorrow at the same time on the same platforms. And that's all for now. Remember, don't pay the rent. Mutual aid will get us through. Trust your neighbors. Talk to you soon.